Well, have you ever heard anything like it in your life? Where else would you hear it but Coast to Coast AM? So, I have to come back and pick on the deserving. Because this is definitely not mainstream. This is quite excellent, having an opportunity to speak with Al Fatty for a couple of hours. The Quran Dilemma. .com is his website. I urge you to check it out. The ones with the deepest knowledge, the deepest education, and the strongest faith are the ones who are going to make it through the next one, whatever that next one may be. So take your temperature, and we'll be right back with Al Fatty. Just give us a couple of minutes here on Coast to Coast AM. We shall resume. Mr. Al Fatty, I know I'm going to get some heat for this, but you know, if I catch heat for asking a question, that just makes me want to ask it even more. And that is, several listeners have sent emails asking if you had an opinion on whether or not, I'm not familiar with this term, taqiyya, the, says here, a religious dissimulation or a legal dispensation whereby a believing individual can deny his faith or commit otherwise illegal or blasphemous acts while they are at risk of significant persecutions. I read through this, I thought, I think that's a little bit of a stretch to levy an accusation like that at our current incumbent. However, there have been a lot of discussions over the years now as to where his, speak of course, President Obama, where his religious faith is. So do you have an opinion on that, or is that, if you don't want to touch it, it's okay with me?
No, I mean, I want to first address the taqiyya, and that's a true teaching found in the Quran. In fact, there is at least four verses that deal with this, and the strongest one of all of them is found in chapter 3, verse 28, and it's clearly in there stated that if a Muslim fears for his life, it is okay for that particular Muslim, whether it's a person, he or she, I should say, to lie. And let's say supposedly someone captures you and say, well, you need to denounce Islam. It's okay to swear and say, yes, I denounced it, and everything to protect yourself, protect your property, protect your family, or even protect your religion and its interests. And the thing is, with taqiyya, it's used sometimes at even at a political level and at state level, where states can also lie to each other for the interest of one state over the other. And now we're going to see, by the way, the concept of taqiyya utilized perfectly by the Muslim Brotherhoods in Egypt, where they are going to say, well, we're not going to mess with this peace treaty with Israel. Yet on the other hand, they really, what they're saying is not truly how they feel about the treaty. They just possibly will try to find a way to deal with Israel, but in the meantime, they do not want to turn their back against the $1.3 billion that we give to them on an annual basis. You know, after all, they can use this money to advance the agenda of Islam. Now, back to your question about the president. Now, I really can't tell, of course, if the president, you know, how he feels inside his heart, if he's a Muslim or not, but can taqiyya be applied in a way where he might hide his faith? Sure, it could be. One thing we know for sure, and I am convinced of it, he has, without a doubt, an affinity towards Muslims. That's his heritage. That's his background. He came from that background. He was born to a Muslim father. He grew up in a Muslim country, actually two of them, Nigeria and Indonesia. But at the same time, taqiyya, yes, could be applied at a level like that. However, you know, some of his actions, of course, so far contradict also that by going against the so-called Muslim radicals that are considered to be hero to religious Muslims, like Al-Qaeda leader, for instance, and others like him. Radical Muslims actually love people like bin Laden because they are advancing Islam and its agenda, and they're considered to be the true followers of Islam. So, you know, I'm getting mixed messages, but there is the affinity in there. I mean, the help. You know, the way that he's helping the Muslim Brotherhoods and allowing them to get to power and turning the other cheek, you know, and looking at what's going on and so on and so forth. All of these things are an indication that there is some sort of an affinity. But you can go back and say, well, that's his heritage, and that's how he feels about it. But at the same time, he has a strategy and a policy where he feels that the U.S. should really lie down a little bit and not be that world power, and let countries try to also grow a little bit and deal with their issues, and we just try to help them instead of trying to hurt them At least that's, I think, the way he's thinking about it. Although I'm not so sure that the U.S. ever hurt anybody, but it seems like this is the direction that is being taken lately.
Well, I'm sure certainly some feelings have been hurt from time to time. I got a quick question for you. I don't mean to digress here, but I think I hear you pronounce it Moslem. Is it Moslem or Muslim? Because I see it both ways.
Well, it's written both ways, and, you know, it's kind of interesting you ask this question because many people ask me this. I became so Americanized that I pronounce it Muslim, but really the true way of saying it in Arabic is Muslim. So whether you write it with a U or an O, it's Muslim is how it's pronounced. And I say Muslim just because, like I said, it's this Americanized tongue that I have now.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Al, but it seems like we've come to the conclusion that this is not necessarily the religion of peace. And yet so many of the people seem very peaceful. They seem like very nice people. They're private and they keep to themselves. I don't know what they talk about when I've left the room, but, you know, it could be I get an idea with that one. But they seem nice enough. How easily, I guess I want to ask, how easily radicalized are what appear to be quite peaceable people?
I mean, you're absolutely correct, and I'm glad you brought up this point, and I want to use this moment to clarify this. We're not talking that all Muslims have to be feared, that you have to worry about them. As I stated before, not all of them really even understand what the Quran says, even if they speak Arabic, or even try to come up with their own conclusions about these commands. We're thankful that about 15% of the Muslim population is what we can label to be terrorists or radicals or fundamentalists out of the 1.4 billion in the world today. Majority of Muslims, by the way, are open-minded. They tend to live in a fantasy world called the religion of peace, and they will try to say that those radicals are hijacking the religion, and I'm thankful for that, too. But the problem with their idea of what Islam is, that they're pacifists. I mean, if you are convinced that Islam is the religion of peace and you're the majority, then how come you cannot really stand up against the minority? Those, you know, 15% in the world, why can't you really go against the Al-Qaeda people? Why do we have to go and send Navy SEAL 6 to take care of him? I mean, you knew about him all this time. You knew about his whereabouts. I'm talking about Pakistan here. And
sure they did. Everybody knew it.
You know, so if you're really promoting peace, wouldn't you go after the people that are damaging your image, basically? And let's look right now in Egypt. You have a minority group that's the Muslim Brotherhoods, yet they want to really stump the majority. And the majority, all they can do is just rally in the streets and that's it. So there is a problem here. You know, majority Muslims who really live in this fantasy world that it's a religion of peace, they're unable to stand up against the radicals. Why? Out of fear. They themselves fear that they might get killed also or terrorized or harmed over this. Now, can you trust every Muslim that you're dealing with? Well, I hope so. But are there 1 out of 10 maybe that they would laugh in your face and then after you leave the room, they're talking about you? Well, sure. Yeah, they're taught to believe this way. They're taught to hide their feelings against you. So you shouldn't be surprised. But at the same time, we really need to try to work with those, at least those who are vocal about their view and they're willing to at least promote peaceful side of Islam, although there is no such thing, but at least if we want to work with them, like for instance, there is a couple of activists here in the U.S. that are always trying to really promote a peaceful side of Islam, if they themselves are under threat from their own Islamic community. I mean, that tells you how peaceful Islam is. If their own community cannot stand the idea that they're promoting the peaceful side of Islam, then we do have a problem.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good at all, does it?
Absolutely.
Well, so now how is this? All right, then. Let me ask you this. Since we already have, I mean, I've even heard places like Tennessee, the courts are up there wrestling with some Sharia law issues. Tennessee? And I'm just wondering how deeply ingrained into let's just call it American fabric, the Sharia law is becoming, and at what rate?
Good question. First of all, I want to assure people that the idea of having Sharia law As a constitution for the U.S., this is something that is far-fetched. I mean, there's no way it will happen. But here is the danger. Islamic Muslim people in general, they are known to congregate together and build communities. And it is through that process that you would begin to see factions and portions of Sharia law being implemented in the community itself. And technically speaking, without having it in the book, I should say, as a law in the book, Sharia law is practiced anyway in the life of a Muslim, because part of Sharia law is how to be a Muslim, how to live as a Muslim, how to worship as a Muslim. So parts of it are already done. I mean, there's no need for it to go to a lawyer and a court and get a, you know, basically a decree or a law in the book saying that you can go and worship in the mosque. I mean, it's part of Sharia. But what they're aiming for usually is what happened in England, for instance, having a family court where you can marry people and divorce them according to Islamic law, where you can deal with child custody according to Islamic law, if there's basically inheritance or commercial laws and transactions and things like that, try to do it under Islamic law instead of under the law of the land. So that's usually where the push is towards. But once you allow something like this, it will basically get completely out of control, and it's a matter of time before now they start pushing even for criminal law. For instance, in England, back in 2008, they only received a sanction for two family courts under Sharia law, but now we have over 82 of them just in the last 4 years. So once you start allowing it to happen in one place, all of a sudden you're going to have it everywhere. And the way usually they try to push for things like this is where they build mega mosques, as you mentioned in Tennessee, for instance, Murfreesboro area. They build a mega mosque, and the mega mosque will be built to attract Muslims and communities around the mosque. And then the mega mosque will be used as a school, as a daycare, as a center for propagation, as training places. Some of them even used to train terrorists, you know, as many times we've heard this. And, you know, we've seen some of the youth who go to these mosques, like, for instance, Minnesota, they end up in Somalia, for instance, and end up part of Al-Shabaab terrorist group over there, which is equivalent to Al-Qaeda and so on and so forth. So that's how it happens. And then you have, of course, many organizations that are backed by people like Saudi government or Muslim Brotherhoods, like, you know, I don't want to name names really, but one of them is very well known. Actually, it's called CARE. You have organizations like this that begin to speak for the community, attack anyone who tries to raise any red flags, discredit anyone who's sharing truth about Islam and its teachings and so on and so forth. And somehow they have lobbyists now, and lobbyists, I should say, and they have enough finances to buy votes. And sooner or later, we're going to start seeing representatives in the House and possibly even in Congress that adhere to the religion of Islam. And once you get there, like it's the case in France and in England also, that's where we will begin to see a lot of movements toward real Sharia law in certain areas and certain towns and certain states.
That's a slightly frightening prospect. Because if they need somebody to go away, they just do, and nobody saw anything.
The thing is, if we use political correctness all the time, then Muslims definitely have liberals on their side, and the liberals are their best friends because they will always help them get that agenda moving. But if we try to at least be reasonable and try to question things, and without being attacked by liberal media and liberals and others that think that we are bigots and we are politically incorrect, then we will be able to at least have some measures of control over this. Now, no one is saying that a Muslim cannot worship according to his belief, or have a mosque, or have their own groups and meetings and so on and so forth. Well, absolutely. It's a free country. No one is denying anyone this right. But when we find out that part of this religion is also calling to topple others and empower them and slave them in a variety of ways, enslave them in a variety of ways, and force your own ideology on them, then we do have a problem, and we definitely have to stand up for our rights. But the problem is you can't even say anything about that, because immediately you'll be singled out and labeled as a bigot, and no one really wants to be in that position.
Well, no, and of course, you know, all you have to do is start yelling the word racist, and everybody just, like, you know, ducks and starts walking close to the rug like some skulking cocker spaniel, you know?
They definitely, the Muslim communities use this perfectly to their advantage, and they have been able to make a lot of advancements as a result of this.
Well, you know, we don't just want to go around fomenting unrest. However, I would like to declare 2013 as the year where we throw into the ash can this political correctness thing from now on, and recognize that political correctness is simply a tool that serves somebody. So do you want to be razzle-dazzled by the fluff and the, oh, aren't they nice? They're so moderate. Because I'll guarantee you, if you're not nice and moderate, you're going to hear stridency and all kinds of rage coming from the other side. And, you know, if these liberal news outlets or whoever, you know, call them what you want, if they push against the Constitution and the law of the land, well, then you push back and you scream louder. And when they call you a maniac and racist and all that, you just say, no, that's what you say. No, actually, we're not. You're the damn racist. I think that's the way it's got to go, Al, because enough of the, you know that expression, no more Mr. Nice Guy? It's like, how long do you just listen to people scream blather and nonsense at you before you go, look, this may tick a few people off, but this is just stupid. We're going to have to oppose this. I mean, why are people so inclined to just take low and go under? And do they just hope it'll go away? Or what's your opinion on this? People just seem to roll over in huge batches for anybody who has a, you know, any kind of an agenda, that, particularly one that that's just a little obtuse enough to make it interesting. You know what I mean?
Well, I think we always want to be nice people, and I want to now use this nice people attitude at an international level. The U.S. in the last 4 years have exhibited actions that are unprecedented. For instance, our stance with Israel is noticeably now at odds with the previous administrations and even probably our history as a nation. Our tolerance of groups like Muslim Brotherhoods and things of that nature, our inability or lack of interest to go after those who killed our ambassador and attacked our embassy, and so on and so forth. All of these sent signals and wrong messages to people over there in that region that we're weak and we are incapable of defending ourselves, and therefore it empowers them to become even louder with us and go even further in their demands and their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And that's you apply this locally, and that's exactly how it goes. And for some reason, I don't know why, we feel like if we speak out the truth that we are not being nice and we're not being politically correct. It really has nothing to do with political correctness or anything else. It's standing for our rights. For instance, let's go to an Islamic country like Saudi Arabia. How come Jewish people are not allowed there? How come Christians cannot even worship in there without even having a building called church, just worship in their own home?
Why are we still doing business with them, Al?
Yeah, well, you know, that's special interest, of course, and oil and rich and wealthiness and everything else.
Mm. Okay, well, you trigger off at these other thoughts, so I interrupt you. Did you get your whole thought out?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was just saying, you know, how come it's okay for them to be intolerant of other people, but yet over here, they have to bend backward, basically.
Yeah, I don't understand that. And I know that there are numerous entries in the White House visitors book from CARE and Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. We'll get into some Muslim Brotherhood stuff, too. I want to ask Al Fatty if he's ever heard of any Nazi Muslim Brotherhood connection, because it just keeps coming up as we talk about these things as time goes by. This is the last Saturday night show of 2012. Whew, 2012. I'm so over it, aren't you? All except for this program. I love it. This is Coast to Coast AM. Got a couple of good questions for our guest tonight. First time on the program, Al Fatty, theQuranDilemma.com. And it's been a really fast program this time. I mean, I think the space-time continuum, it's doing its thing. Seems to every Saturday night. Tell you what, let's get through our last little break so we can have a nice long sweep up to the top of the hour and head for the exit door as late as possible, just like always. Okay? John Dean with you tonight. It's a real privilege. Thank you. I've been with you for, the entire calendar year. And did I mention it's been a real pleasure? Thanks. Stand by. We'll be right back with Al Fatty on Coast to Coast AM. Mr. Al Fatty, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the program tonight. Let me just fill in a couple of little blanks. We have a beautiful little mosaic here, and just a couple of little dabs will hook us up. You mentioned earlier that that the Prophet Muhammad was he had an angel appear before him, and it was according to his recounting of the incident, the angel Gabriel. So I guess my question is so Islam and other religions share the same, what we would call biblical characters? How do we wind up with the same Gabriel? Is it the same Gabriel as in the Old Testament?
Well, this is excellent, that you brought up this point. Anytime you have a religion, you really have to have a basis for it. So, for instance, we look at the Bible, and then the historical teachings in there, and you see like prophets, for instance, in the Old Testament, each one of them is built in upon the previous one and his own teachings and his the promises of Yahweh and so on and so forth. When it came to Muhammad, he had to start somewhere. So he definitely borrowed a lot of stories from Jewish teachings like the Talmud and the Mishnah and the Midrash and other extra-biblical books. And he also borrowed some stories from the Bible itself, and at the same time, he also borrowed stories from the Gospels and so on and so forth to try to justify to his followers and, of course, to the Jewish communities of his time and the Christian communities of his time that he is a prophet along the same lineage of prophets that they're familiar with. And yes, when you open the Quran, you'll find some stories that are similar to the Bible, not identical, but at least somewhat similar. And yes, indeed, he used the name of the angel Gabriel at a later time. In fact, if we study the Quran, we discover that it took him 14 years to identify this angel as Gabriel, which is kind of interesting. How come you didn't know his name the first time he met you? But he did that. Why? Because he moved from Mecca to Medina, and there were a lot of Jewish in that area, so he wanted to buy their support and impress them by showing that the angel that they're familiar with is the angel that appeared to him. And I hopefully answered that question.
A little common ground there.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Now, somebody wanted me to ask you, are there instructions anywhere for true Muslims to take action on those that misuse the religion, like there is for instructions on how to treat an infidel, for example?
Absolutely.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there are instructions. In fact, in our book, The Quran Dilemma, we touch base on that in two chapters. For instance, chapter 9, chapter 5 of the Quran, both of them give instructions in dealing with infidels, dealing with those who do not follow Islam, even dealing with Christians and Jews, calling both of them, Christians and Jews, as infidels, calling on killing infidels. And here's the trick, by the way. Many Muslims will say, well, we're only allowed to kill in a state of war. We're not in a state of war, but the radicals will say we're absolutely in a state of war. Here's an example. For instance, Al-Qaeda will say, well, we are in a state of war. Why? Because the U.S. have invaded two Islamic countries, and every Muslim now is commanded to defend those Islamic countries, Afghanistan and Iraq. Just by saying this, they had thousands of young Muslim men join them and fight with them. And by the way, at some point when I was young, almost 16 years old, I was willing to go to Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, if you remember, in 1979 and during the early 80s as well. I wanted to go. Why? Because it was a call of duty for Muslims to go and defend another Islamic nation. And the way the radicals will justify it, they will say, listen, Islam started and spread. It was only one state called the Muslim state. There were no borders to separate Afghanistan from Pakistan from Saudi. It was only one nation. So just because we have borders right now doesn't stop us from being all Muslims and all have the same duty. So yes, there is commands and very clear commands to do so.
Was this an in your opinion, was this an inspired writing, or was there always a political agenda behind it? I mean, that's kind of a sledgehammer question. It's like, boom, there it is. But there it is.
Oh, no. I appreciate that question. Of course, you're asking me today as a former Muslim, and after done all my studies and research and evaluation, finally deciding that it's not the religion that I want to follow, and I went the other way, I can assure you there's a lot of political agenda in there. How do we know this? Very simple. If we were to try to organize the Quran, remember I said it's not organized chronologically, but there are ways, by the way, that has been done to organize it chronologically. You will see that many of those revelations, so-called revelations, were tied to events, and some of them has to do with political events and agendas and so on and so forth. So yes, there is agendas behind each of these revelations. And in fact, there is a science by itself called the reasons for revelations. And if you study it, it will tell you, well, this verse was revealed because of this, and this verse was revealed because of that, and this command for killing was revealed because of this. And so there are always agendas tied to these verses.
You know, Al, a lot of times I let my curiosity overwhelm any diplomacy or discretion that I might otherwise have demonstrated to the audience. But you know, you hear everything, and when you get a chance to debunk some stuff, it's just irresistible. And you know, we hear people, I don't know how many times I've heard that, how many dozens of times I've heard somebody, generally over the, I don't hear the citizenry saying this, I hear it's always over the mass media, the mainstream media, that it's, well, it's poverty and it's this and it's that that enables Muslims to get jacked up so easily over stuff like, for example, Salman Rushdie's book that back in the late 80s, early 90s, I took a look at that Satanic Verses thing, and it's like, I mean, I'll just tell you, it was the silliest thing I could only get through like maybe a couple of chapters, and I went, I'm not doing this. Maybe I didn't stay with it long enough, but I didn't really see the reason to put a fatwa on the guy. You know, I just thought it was stupid. And this video is like beyond bad. It's just awful video making. And I'm just wondering, is it the poor quality that makes it even worse? Does that enrage them even more? They need a higher quality piece if we're going to be critical? Or what's up with this? They just seem to get just so upset over idiotic stuff. I'm sorry, I'll keep going.
No. This is an excellent observation, by the way. And in fact, if we were to go to the Quran, for instance, chapter 26 of the Quran, verses 180 to 183, talks about trying to judge others and compare and contrast with others using the same standards that others are using. For instance, I'm going to use a quick example here. As a Christian apologist myself and other colleagues of mine, if we try to refute something that is found in the Quran, we go to the top-notch historical Islamic commentators and books and classical books, and we say, listen, your own renowned people said this and this and this and this. On the other hand, Muslims, when they want to refute me, they go to liberal media, liberal books, liberal this, liberal that, and they use even questionable sources sometimes because, why? It suits their agenda. In other words, they're not using the same equal, basically, scale that we should be standing on. So even if Salman Rushdie did an excellent quality book and used even the Quran to cite everything that he was talking about, he would still be in hot water. Even if, by the way, the movie that we're talking about, The Innocence of Muslims, which is 15 minutes, like I said, of fame, based on historical Islamic documentation. It wasn't faking anything, by the way, about the Prophet. Maybe the way they did it, looked like in a funny way and a comic way, but the information are accurate, and it comes from Islamic sources. So Muslims, unfortunately, are programmed not to accept any criticism. It doesn't matter if it's high criticism, low criticism. You just have to take it and accept it. And if you are a person who is not a Muslim, you need to put up with it or shut up and do not criticize me, because my religion is the only superior religion. you do not know anything about it, and therefore you should always respect it. Now, I'm going to go back to Salman Rushdie, by the way. Salman Rushdie named his book after a historical event that took place in the life of the Prophet. And the reason why it's called the Satanic Verses is this. And I know you're going to laugh at what I'm going to tell you, but it's even in our book, The Quran Dilemma, we wrote about this story. And it's documented in classical Islamic sources. I mean, it's not like he made up the story. He brought up the story from their own sources. Supposedly, the Prophet of Islam, at some point, even though he was fighting idolatry and the worship of idols, in order to please the Arabs of his time, of his country, of his town, Mecca, and specifically his own tribe, he came with a verse and says, you know, listen, my God is okay with you to worship these three specific goddesses. And at that point, his people rejoiced and they said, oh, then we're not enemies anymore. Let's all bow to these goddesses now. And Muhammad bowed with them. But then later, I guess his conscience did not like this and went back and says, oh, my bad. I actually didn't receive this revelation from God. It was Satan who revealed this verse to me, and therefore I'm going to cancel this verse. And hence we get the term Satanic Verses. So the story is authentic. The story is historical. The story comes from Islamic sources. Yet Salman Rushdie got in hot water, and Khomeini issued a fatwa against him, and he had to live in hiding for over 10 years, basically.
It was finally lifted, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's finally lifted, but if I were him, I'd always watch my back.
Oh, yeah, I imagine so. That's absolutely unbelievable. Unless you can talk to someone who's lived it, you're just going to get a bunch of, you know, really, it's third party. Unless they've lived it, they heard about it from someone else, and you've lived it. We got about probably 8 minutes left, maybe a little longer. What would you like to leave everybody with? Just really anything, because I had no idea that I would be able to have you as a guest on the program, and just delighted that you're here because you've cleaned up so many misconceptions. I do have one last question for you, and that is, so deception is okay. As far as dealing with infidels, deception is no problem. And the second part of that question is, when we got to the part that sort of neutralized 100 and some odd verses that came before regarding striking the necks of various infidels and unsuitables, did the practitioners of Islam just decide to just let that go? Or do the preceding chapters somehow engender a feeling that it's almost like the chase scene is about to start? If we continue reading and we continue being devoted to the scripture, pretty soon we're going to be able to pull our swords out and straighten this world out. I mean, I just wonder what's feeding all of this, Al. It's almost like it's almost like a drug that you read. And I don't understand how you can blow up your own kids. I don't understand any of that. You hear everything. You hear Al-Qaeda is actually Al-CIA. You got this broad that calls herself Syrian Girl that comes on various networks talking about, oh, no, it's just generally understood that the CIA and Al-Qaeda are the same. Well, unless somebody a little bit more credible than that tells that to me, I'm not just going to buy it hook, line, and sinker, but it seems as though we probably better get a better grasp of what we're facing if we have an Islamic foe in the Middle East, and we're all over the Middle East, can't seem to leave, and we also have a growing population here. So just pick any of that you want to address.
Well, I mean, simply put, we're dealing with a teaching, an ideology, and a book that promotes hatred against anyone who's not a Muslim. So we're not dealing with people, I don't want to start this way, but the people are being fed from this source. And it is this source that causes all of this grief and these problems. And if you, as a Muslim, try to water it down and try to harmonize it and say, no, that's not what it teaches, you will find yourself as a moderate Muslim in hot water from the radicals and the fundamentalists. And if you're a Shia and you say, well, the teaching is different, you'll find yourself in hot water from the Sunnis. And if the Sunnis will say the same thing, they'll find themselves in hot water from the Shia. So you don't even know who is the true Muslim. And I can tell you this, Simply put, the true Muslim is the radical Muslim who knows the Quran and adheres to it and follows its teachings and want to be obedient to the God who revealed it. And if he would do so, unfortunately for you and me, they're going to come after us, terrorize us, and do whatever it takes to advance his agenda. And that's where the problem is. It's the teaching that is found in a so-called divine book. And a person will tell you who follows this divine book, these are not the words of a prophet. These are not the words of a human. This is the word of God. And if God wants me to terrorize you, I have no choice. I'm going to have to do it because he commanded me to do so. In fact, the Quran, by the way, ironically, said exactly the same thing when the Muslims on those days, the days of Muhammad, were kind of wondering and questioning, why do we have to go and kill our own tribesmen? And why do we have to kill our own family and fathers and mothers and sisters? And the verse supposedly was revealed saying, you know, you're not doing it. God is doing everything, but he's just using you to do this. So in other words, don't feel bad, you know. I mean, you're really, your conscience should be just fine. And that's the problem. When you feed children at a very young age, like in my case, I was 3 years old, when I'm being fed these kind of teachings and being told who to hate and who to love, after a while, it becomes part of who you are.
Oh, yeah.
You accept it. And you move on with it. I mean, if you tell a person that you are a bad person, and after 4 years, 5 years of doing this, they're going to believe they're bad people. But imagine if you tell them you need to hate the infidel, you need to kill the infidel, you need to do this. I mean, why do we have people in the Middle East hate the Jews all the time, especially Muslims? Because they're sad that the Jews are their enemies from day one.
Yeah, see, that's not comic book stuff. This is real. This is really happening. That's what people need to understand. You're not making it up.
Absolutely. That is correct. And that's what's so scary about this. And that's why I try to, our ministry here and our mission is to try to educate people and the public at large about the teaching. I mean, I'm not standing here and saying, you know, hate Malcolm. All I'm saying is watch out for the teaching and we need to do something about it. We cannot just bend backward and let it just rule over us. And we need to help those Muslims who are really moderate, who really want to speak out against it, but they're unable because they're afraid as well. Like the rest of us, they are in danger of facing death or being called the Islamophobes or being called bigots or whatever. But we have to stand and take a stand against it. And unfortunately, so far, it's not happening in a collective way. It's happening in an isolated, individualized way.
Well, we've got time for a short answer on this one, Al-Fatty, but do you think Iran wants a war with us or not?
Oh, they absolutely want a war with us, and they know that the way they can get to us is through Israel. And here is the part about Iran, by the way, that it makes it so dangerous. Here we go back again to Islam and its teachings. Iran is considered to be the stronghold for what is called the Shia Islam. And according to Shia theology, end times will not happen until the so-called the 12th Imam will appear on the scene and lead a battle against the enemies of Islam. And the only way he would appear is if the environment is right for him. And how would the environment be right? If you create chaos. And that's what Iran is trying to do, basically, with Israel.
Understood. All right, his websites are, well, is thequrandilemma.com, thequrandilemma.com, and also just the Quran, thequran.com. The book is The Quran Dilemma. Al, what's next for you? Do you lecture, or do you hit the lecture circuit, or what happens next?
Well, we're working on volume two of our book also, even though each volume will be independent, but we're trying to finish analyzing the entire book. I'm also working on a number of TV shows that I'm taping on this issue, and our show is called The Islamic Dilemma. And people
Islamic Dilemma.
IslamicDilemma.com.
You got to come back on the program sometime. It would be a pleasure to have you back.
I would love to. Thank you for the invitation.
Have a happy 2013. Well, that wraps it up. You know what next weekend is? It's our anniversary together. I look forward to sitting in the chair with you again next Saturday night. And remember, the divine in us recognizes the divine in you. Good night.